He's drunk all the time. He's like all the time. And he's like a millionaire and had a really great successful career. And, you know, as like a international businessman, and he speaks like four languages, and he raced for Yamaha for a little while, and he wins photography contests, and like everything's fine. Like, it's just great, you know? I mean, he's retired. He's been retired for a long time. He's still drunk every day. I fucking hate him, man. I always wanted to be him. But, I mean, it's true. Like, he's driving around somewhere around the country in like, a motorhome that costs more than my house, like, drunk right now, and, like, really happy. Really incredibly happy, you know? With, like, tequila for breakfast and like, happy. And everything, he never goes to detox. He never wrecks his car. He wins most of the fights he gets in. He's like this great guy. And I was never that guy, but I wanted to be that guy. And I started going to school, and I don't know what grade it was or how old I was, but I was thinking about it today when I was talking to my son that when I was a little bit younger than he is now, I started becoming aware of this internal dialogue that like I hated school. I'm not good at it. And I'm going to school and I'm starting to become really aware. Like, the thoughts are coming stronger. I don't know if that's puberty or if it's just getting older, but I'm walking around during the day and I'm thinking, you know, I hate these people. Like, I really hate them. And I'm starting to gain a real awareness of what humanity is, you know? It's ugly, awful, cruel animals walking around in expensive clothes. I don't want to be around them. I don't like this. They'll go out of their way to make me feel bad all the time. Not just the teachers, but they're pretty much the worst. But everybody else. And I don't want any part of it. I don't like it. And it got louder and it got louder. And I had one friend, and he had an older brother who was a DJ at Chico College. And he was coming down for Easter break when I was in, I guess it was 7th grade. And Pete came down, and he showed up. And me and John, my best friend, had been listening to this music, but you really couldn't get to it. You know what I mean? Like, it was happening, kind of, but you just couldn't really get to it. And Pete showed up, and he had a leather jacket, and he had a mohawk, and he had an old truck, and a safety pin through his nose. And we went out drinking. Right? And from, like, that night we went out drinking and we're racing around in this old truck and we're running over people's mailboxes and we're driving on the wrong side of the road, making people swerve out of the way. And I suddenly was, like, the best I had ever felt in my whole life. And 'cause I knew all those people. They were those horrible, ugly, evil people that made me feel bad, that punched me in the hallway, you know? If it wasn't them, it was their parents. And we were running them off the road, and it was awesome. And give me another beer. And, you know, it was their mailbox. And that was my introduction to alcoholism and antisocial behavior. And I really liked it a lot. It was the best thing I ever tasted. And, you know, I started drinking. There's always alcohol around my house. So I'm drinking when I can, what I can get away with. And, you know, my parents would throw these big parties, and there was always leftovers from that, and I'd squirrel away what I could. And then we found this guy down by our junior high, and he would buy us anything we wanted if we let him keep the change. And he was a homeless guy, but he was a great guy. And so now we're drinking vodka before school, and that internal dialogue starts to change, right? Alcohol's, like, great that way. Because if you drink in the morning when you're, like, 13 years old, like, that internal dialogue started to change where, you know, I used to walk like real small through school and all of a sudden I'm walking big, you know, and I'm looking at people and I'm looking them in the eye and I'm thinking, go ahead, man, punch me. I'm not going to punch you back, but I don't care anymore. And I'm sitting in class one day and I'm looking around and alcohol like cleared my thinking and made me smarter. And I'm sitting in there and I'm liquored up pretty good. And me and two other buddies we had split a couple of pints of vodka before school. And I'm sitting there and I'm getting smarter by the moment. And I look around and like the bell rings, right? And I'm like, I got it. I know what this is. I've heard about this before. They ring a bell and everybody runs to go eat food, right? They train dogs like this. This has nothing to do with education. This is social training. This is social modeling. They ring a bell, we all run somewhere where they want us to go. That's what this is. They're training me to work in their crappy stores and take crap off of people I hate for the rest of my life. I don't want to do this, and I quit. And I thought, I know what I like to do. I like to drink, you know, and drinking makes me feel happy, and all of you people in this school make me feel bad. So, like, what are you going to go for? Because me, you know, you can be a miserable dog, or you can be a happy drunk. I'm going for the booze, so I'm out, right? And I remember my parents looking at me, you know. I mean, by this time, I'm already tattooing myself. I got a big fuck you on my arm, you know, because that's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm feeling. I'm becoming artistic now that the alcohol is working. And I got the little string wrapped around the needle, and I'm sitting there, hate all those people, you know. So I'm getting all these great tattoos by myself, and me and my friends are sitting around tattooing each other and drunk and you know, shaving each other's heads. And this was the late 70s, and it was the burgeoning Southern California punk rock scene. And it was the greatest thing in the world because everybody there was messed up. I mean, everybody was drunk. Everybody, like, had this enormous propensity for, like, violence that they couldn't really fulfill, you know? I mean, we're all scrawny kids with you know, messed up hair and bad tattoos beating the hell out of each other. And it was great. Everybody was drunk. Everybody had a messed up home life. I mean, I didn't really, but I lied a lot. This is the truth. I swear to God, I remember standing outside of a place that was... There's this little enclave near downtown that's mostly like there's like a bunch of pubs and the Princess of Wales and all these like little bridge places, and they would serve me. So I'm down there and I came out of a blackout like 16 years old, and I'm telling somebody about my mother's gambling problem, like, and I'm like, I'm listening to myself talking and think, well, that's not true, but I see that they're really interested, so I'm consciously embellishing. So now there's this joy to my hatred of humanity, you know. There's this happiness because I realize that, like, I'm smarter than all you, and I'm better than all you. That I'm not a trained dog. That I alcohol made me superior to everybody just about, you know, and I'm really overjoyed about it, and I really revel in upsetting people, you know. I mean, in any possible circumstance, If I can agitate people, if I can throw up publicly, I'm like overjoyed about it. And I'm hanging out on the street and I'm sleeping in a park and I'm crashing wherever I can, and people are weirder and things are meaner and the drinking's going on, and you know, by the time I was 15 years old, I was living in a canyon. And me and a couple of my buddies are walking over one of his girlfriend's house because her parents got money, and she's feeding us. You know, she's bringing food out and stuff, and we're walking up there, and this guy rode by. And back then, things were. If you had a mohawk, man, it was on. Like, it was a war. You walked outside, everybody wanted to hit you. Everybody felt that you had put yourself in cops. You know, I'm bleeding on the side of the street, all beat up, and cops are like, "You asked for it, man." You know, and I mean, there's not. So we're walking around the street, and this guy in an AC/DC t-shirt cruises by on a moped and, you know, calls us a bunch of names, and we're back at him. And he comes around again, and, you know, this time we're looking for rocks to throw at him, and there's a culture war going on. And you know, we're drinking, and he goes around the corner again, and I hear this big noise, and we go up there and zip around the corner, and a lady had run a stop sign and hit him, and he's laying in the street, and he's bleeding out his ears, and he's dying. And I was completely amused. I had lost... In that short period of time, I had just lost every bit of humanity that might have ever been in me. I don't know what's wrong with me, but at that point, I was like, he deserves it. He hurt my feelings. He called me a name. And he's like, he's twitching. He's dying. They're saying he's going to die, you know? I mean, the paramedics show up, and I didn't care. And it went down from there, you know? I mean, that was, at that point, I was still a sweet kid. And my drinking over the years got meaner and weirder, and living on the street, a lot of bad crap happens, and for some reason it always seems to happen to me. I started showing up in nut wards and just I don't even know how to describe my drink. It was like, I came to in a taco, what was it? It's not even Taco Bell, it's Del Taco. A Del Taco parking lot, and I don't know where I am. And I don't recognize where I am. So I just stayed in the parking lot for like a week and a half. Just bumming. I mean, they throw out food every night, so I'm well fed. And people are going in and out all the time, so I'm bumming change. And I see there's an Albertsons across the street, so I'm getting the change, going over, buying beer, going back, just sitting in the parking lot, you know? And they kind of got used to me there. Like, I guess over the first few days, they're like, why is that guy using the bathroom again, you know? But after that, like, it became my home until I figured out a way out. And I don't remember what that was. I'm sure I was drunk and hopped in somebody's car and said, hey, can I go with you? Because I did that a lot and ended up a lot of places. And by the time I was 19, I had a motorcycle, and I was cruising downtown, and I'm drunk, and usually I'm a really good drunk motorcyclist, and I don't know that my drinking progressed. I mean, I couldn't get a lot when I was young, you know. Thank God Tijuana was like 6 miles away, because you can drink, as long as you get some money, you can drink all you want in Tijuana, but getting alcohol was a problem for a while, and I met guys on the street that you know, said, you can drink Listerine. I'm like, that's not bad, it hurts, but it makes me feel better, so I was not real picky, and I was on a Southern Comfort, because you know when you start drinking Southern Comfort, you can't stop, because it's going to be ugly, right? Because it's sweet, you know? The sweet stuff just killed me, and I couldn't afford anything that wasn't crap, so I'm living on Southern Comfort, and I'm like 3 days into this binge, and I'm hardly sleeping, I'm just drinking, and I go to meet these girls on this motorcycle I got, and I misjudge a turn, and run into the San Diego trolley, which doesn't actually leave the tracks, but it goes this way, and I'm going that way, and I hit the, it's amazing what alcohol really is, an awesome painkiller, because I didn't feel it for like 3 hours, and I kept trying to convince them I was fine and to leave me alone, and when they came to save me, and they ended up having to take my whole knee apart and pretty much replace it when I was 19 years old. They were going to cut it off. The first thing they said is, we're going to cut your knee off. And I went, oh no, you know. And then they said, oh, we can save it. And I went, oh good. I ended up, I was loaded, and I called one of those lawyers on TV, and they got me some money for hitting a trolley. I don't know how that works. The legal system is awesome. I love the legal system. You can run into a trolley with a motorcycle, and the city should have never put that trolley there. So, can't you see he's drunk and on a motorcycle? So, I was able to move indoors and get my first real, like, apartment. And at some point during that, I had some money, and I tried some different things. At one point, I decided I didn't have a problem with drugs, so I thought I'd be a drug dealer because I'd be rich, and what I found out was that I'm a really overly friendly drunk. So I'd sell a bag, then I'd buy a bottle, I'd drink the bottle, and then I'd give the rest of the weight because I love everyone. And that was a bad career choice. And I went into a blackout one night, and then I destroyed the inside of that place. I mean, I ripped the plaster off the walls and destroyed a potted palm and my foot and by kicking it to death, and I don't know what happened. I was in a blackout, and I thought I was in a pretty good mood before that happened. And I came to in the morning, and I didn't have a place to live anymore. My roommate had gotten together with the landlord, and there was a copy of the lease sitting there, and my name wasn't on it anymore, and there was a little note that said, people are always afraid to, like, talk to me, you know? They, like, leave me little notes and say, you've got, like, 3 hours to get all your stuff out. I don't know what that... I remember my drinking as being sort of like Frankenstein's monster, you know? I mean, I just want love, you know? And everybody's backing away and torches and stuff and big pitchforks. And I just wanted to, like, be friends, you know? And everybody always seemed to be saying, we're afraid of you. You know, we don't know what you're going to do next. And I'm like, nothing. I just want to sleep on the couch. No, you destroy things. No, I don't. No. You know, and I never could figure. I always thought they were overreacting. You know, I thought they were dramatic and mean. And anyways, I went out and I threw what I owned in a backpack, and I drove up to North Park, and there was a place up there that served booze for breakfast, and I'm in there looking at some eggs and drinking and singing Freddie Fender songs in Spanish off the jukebox and kind of sobbing, and this chick came in, and I didn't really, I kind of knew her peripherally from around the scene. I didn't like her, and she came over and sat down and started talking to me while I'm drinking breakfast, and we start talking, and in a couple of minutes, like, it worked out that, like, she had a really good job, and she had a place to live, and she had a car, and at that point in my life, that constituted true love. So by that night, I had a place to live and a steady paycheck coming in and a nice car to drive. And we lived together for a minute, and I was just drunk. And I guess she thought it was fun or something. Maybe she just really wanted to fix somebody. But I'm living with her, and I'm just hanging out, you know. Where are you? I'm at the park. Thank God there weren't cell phones in. And I vaguely remember her saying, we're pregnant. And I said, what do we do? You know, and I, from what I've seen, and there's photographic evidence that her answer was, we get married. So we did that. I don't remember it really. There are pictures of me all beat up in somebody else's old suit and like hair. And I'm, you know, looking really gray and sick. And we got married, and I don't really remember any of it, honestly. I was just drunk. I mean, I was plowed drunk every day, the whole time, all the time. There's money. So she's a bank manager. There's money. I'm drinking. And about the only thing I remember from that whole 9 months, and I'm not proud of this, but the only thing I remember from those 9 months of her being pregnant is having to go home one night and sit on the floor next to the bed and wake her up. It was like 4 a.m. and explain to her how it wasn't my fault that I had wrapped our car around a telephone pole. And that even though she's like 8.5 months pregnant, we'll figure out a way to get her to the hospital when the time comes, but there's no more car. And if the police knock on the door, I'm not here. And her mother bought us another car, and I was drinking, and she said, it's time. And I said, okay. And we drove to the hospital, and they said, it might be false labor. Walk around for a little while and drink a half a beer, and maybe it'll go away. And so she walked around for a little bit, and then we got in the car, and I drove across the street to the liquor store, and she gave me the credit card, which I don't know if I had ever been allowed to touch. And I walked in, and I walked out, and I said, honey, they only sell six packs. And she drank a half a beer, and I drank five and a half, and we went in, and we had a daughter. And they handed me that this little like ball of like blankets, a little head sticking out, and I looked at her, and I was just absolutely in love. Like, I was like, this is it, man. This is awesome. She's so cool. Like, I still didn't like my wife, but I'm like, I love this kid. And I went out in the parking lot. I held her until they made me let go of her, and I went out in the parking lot, and I lit a cigarette, and I cried, and I thought, this is it. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't ever want to drink again. I want to go. I had no idea how all those people I hated did the stuff they did, like what a job was or like how you got one or what you did when you got there and all that stuff. But I'm like, I'm planning on like how good my lawn is going to look and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm driving home and I'm thinking, where do you get one of those like the stork thing that says like it's a girl, you know? I'm all worked out. I'm excited. I'm going to get flowers. I'm so excited. And I'm never going to drink again. And I walked in to the house, and I made a left in the hallway, and I made a right into the bedroom. And as I was walking in the bedroom, I noticed there were a couple of bottles of wine sitting on a dresser there. And I thought, I'm going to have a glass of wine, and then I'm going to throw those out. I'm never going to drink again, but I'm going to celebrate by having a glass of wine, because I'm not going to be able to sleep, and I got to pick them up. That was the first time maybe ever I thought I'm just going to have a glass of wine. Like, I never wanted to have a glass of wine, but I made it back home 6 days later with my new best friend Gary. I don't know where he came from, but he had like medieval weaponry and a pot farm in the mountains, I mean, really, we get out and there's like, he's got like a snake and a crossbow. And I walked in and I looked at her, and I don't know that I've ever felt that much shame in my whole life, you know, and knowing that her parents, she had to call them up and say, I don't know where he is. I don't know where the car is. You know, she's just had a baby, and they don't know where I am. And I felt so much shame and so much remorse. And I said, okay, that's it. You know, Gary, you got to go back wherever you came from. I'm not going to drink anymore. And that might have lasted, I don't know, 10 or 12 hours, you know, and then it started the trying to nurse it by with some malt liquor and feel okay. And she had to go back to work because I wasn't going anywhere. And so now I'm a house dad. And every night I pass out and I swear I'm never going to drink again to myself. Not to her, because she isn't even listening to me. And every day about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock in the morning, I change my mind. I just changed. I didn't know that I had an obsession of the mind, that I would just drink a little today, that I was just going to drink enough to get by. I had no idea. And I had no idea that once I started drinking, it wasn't going to stop. And so I'd have to go get something to drink. I mean, it would just become imperative. I didn't know that. I needed to get something to drink. So I'd throw her in the baby backpack and we'd hop on the skateboard and shoot down the hill to the liquor store and get a fifth of E&J brandy, because that's what was always on sale. And I'd drink some, and then we'd skate back, and I got to tell you, I was a much better father drinking than I was not drinking. Not drinking, I couldn't pay attention to her, you know? Not drinking, I was nervous, and I was upset, and I was agitated, and I was sick. And as soon as I got drinking, yeah, I was a great guy, you know? And then every day, that lady I was married to would come home, and she'd find me passed out on the floor, and would find our daughter, you know, a full diaper, screaming in the bedroom. And I knew. I didn't pass out anymore. I laid there and I could hear everything, and my mind was working 1,000 miles an hour. But I drank to the point where my body didn't work anymore, and I would just lay there and hate me more than she could. And I eventually ended up out on the street again. And that next, like, I got locked up for 90 days at one point, and. They talked about AA, you know, and actually it was at a place. I probably should. I don't want to waste too much time. What time does this meeting end? 20 minutes. I got 20 minutes. All right, I'm going to talk fast. All right, so I get popped. I get busted for absolutely nothing. Like I am a chronic offender of like public urination and vagrancy and things like that. You can get in trouble for eating other people's garbage. So a judge says, you're a mess, man, you know, and you need to be punished for your crimes against humanity. So they said they through some sort of genetic quirk, they find out that I have enough Native American blood in me that I qualify to be sent to the American Indian Freedom Ranch. So here I get off this fucking, I'm shaking and I'm sick, and I get off this van, and I mean, we're driving for like a lifetime into parts of like California I didn't know existed, and I'm looking and it's bad, and I get off this van and there's like 50 something like guys from reservations, right? Like long black hair, like Indian. I get off with a mohawk and stand there, and they're all standing there looking at me, and I'm looking at them, and one of them walks over, his name was Andrew, and he walks up and he goes, how you doing, chief? And I went, this is exactly what I need. So I spent 90 days up there, and they talked about AA, and I didn't know what they were talking about. And I tried to understand, and I got out of there, and I was never going to drink again. I was going to get my family back. And I went to a few meetings, and one day after a meeting, there was a guy there who had a bunch of time. And I walked up to him, and I asked him, you know, I said, my life is a wreck, man. I'm falling apart, and I don't have anybody, and what do I do? And he kind of reared back, and he went, one day at a time. And I say, yeah, but what? And he's like, well, just easy does it. You want to keep coming back, you know? And it's just like, this guy's sitting there and like reading off these fucking bumper stickers, and he's He's killing me. Like, he's waterboarding me, right? I'm dying of alcoholism, and he's got bumper stickers he's memorized, you know? He spent like 20 years memorizing these bumper stickers, and I'm dying. So I'm drunk again. And over that, however long that period was, it was horrific. And I drank myself to the point where I really couldn't think in whole sentences anymore. And I was just an animal living on the street. And finally, I made it, I don't know, somehow I ended up in Mexico for something. And somebody upset me, some guy did something I didn't like, and I'm drunk, and I'm not going to drink today, but I'm not going to drink today while I've got this, like, water glass of tequila. And I don't know who I meant to put the cigarette out on, but it ended up in his girlfriend's face, and now, like, every big Mexican guy in, like, Tijuana is going to beat the living shit out of me. So that was what happened. We took care of that, and I made it back across the border somehow, and I made it to my last friend's house, this dirtbag who was my last friend, and I got to his house, and I looked inside, and he was out cold, so I broke in and drank his vodka, and the next day he needed to go somewhere, and I asked him if I could go with him, because at that point I suffered from a loneliness that no sane person can suffer from. Maybe like an astronaut in a movie, but that's it. Like, I was alone. I was alone, alone. And I asked this guy if I could go with him, and he said, yeah. And we went for a ride, and we went and picked up whatever it was he needed from a hardware store. And then we left there, and I started giving him directions. I'm like, hey, man, can we go up there? He's like, yeah. And he starts driving. I've got a big plastic glass full of vodka and blue Kool-Aid. It was the new bright blue Kool-Aid they just come out with. And That was sometime towards the end of March in 1990. And we drove up and we went to, I guess I had seen this unity symbol out front of this place, but we happened to pull up at like 11:55, and we walked in and we sat down. And I, to this day, I have no idea what the hell he was thinking or why he's sitting there drunk and stupid next to me. I'm fishing through the ashtray, you know, getting good butts and these guys are getting, I'm talking from the podium for 5 minutes and sitting down, and this thing starts happening in my head. Like, all of a sudden, the internal dialogue switched, and I'm saying to myself, that guy's going to be my sponsor. Now, why I would want one, I have no idea, or what one does, I have no idea. And I still got vodka in the truck I'm going to go drink, so I don't know why I'm thinking this, or why the hell I'm sitting in there. And there was this one guy who got up there, and he was dirty, and he was angry, and that's my people, you know, that's what I like. And after the meeting, I followed him outside. He was booking. And I ran through the crowd and out there, sir, sir, excuse me, sir, you know. And he turned around, and by this time, my hair had sort of worked its way into, like, the most horrible excuse for dreadlocks. And I was like 120 pounds. I mean, I was dying. I was dying on the inside. My body was wasting away. I was in the final stages of alcoholism, and I was 24 years old. And this guy, like, was like on a treadmill or something. Like he turned around, all of a sudden he's in my face, and he goes, what do you want? And I said, I want to stop drinking, and I got a daughter, and I can't see her, and I'm so alone, and I'm so the pain, you know? And he said, when did you have your last drink? And with all the honesty at my command, I looked him right in the eye, and I said, it's been 2 weeks. And he said, go over there and sit with that guy. Because, you know, like, every clubhouse has that guy, you know, who's like, you know. And so I'm over there and I'm sitting with that guy. And he's reading the bumper stickers to me again. And this dude comes back with a motorhome. And all of a sudden, these cars start coming in after him. And I go get in the motorhome with like five other guys. And, you know, by that time, the boost is wearing off, and I'm climbing into a strange motorhome in a strange place with five other guys. And where I'm from, you don't do that unless some cash has changed hands. You know what I'm talking about? And I get in there, and the alcohol is wearing off, and I'm getting more and more scared, and they're getting more and more calm, and I'm getting more and more scared, and I'm getting uptight, and I'm starting to get wiggly, and all of a sudden, I'm getting sick, and now I'm throwing up. And then I'm throwing up nothing, you know? I'm hopping up and down on my knees, puking up nothing. And this guy who I asked if he'd help me, he's sitting in the bathtub, in this little plastic bathtub with his feet up on the wall, smoking, and saying shit to me that's just cruel. He's like, you do this a lot, you know? And You know, do you think that most people go out and have a beer and end up like in a motorhome with a strange guy puking nothing, you know? And they detox me, you know? They're feeding me honey and orange juice and I'm puking that up and I'm listening. I can hear them around the corner, you know? Like one of them, they're taking shifts on me as I'm like just wretched And I'm hearing him say stuff that's making it worse. You know, like one guy walks out of the bathroom and I hear the guys out there going, how's he doing? You know, and he's like, oh, he's shaking like a dog shit and razor blades. Now I got a visual of what I look like. And I'm in there just going, oh, and they're asking me questions and I'm answering them because I think, you know, I don't know where I got the idea, but I got the idea that if I answer enough questions, you're going to give me a beer because it's just inhuman to watch somebody go through this and beer is the reward. And so, anyways, after the horrible stuff gets passed, which takes a few days, he says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to get sober. You know, he told me a story. They had all told me their story. They reading out the book, tell me a story. And I, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to get sober. And he literally looked at me and he went, that's too bad. And I said, what? And he said, from what you've told me, man, you're a chronic alcoholic. Guys like you don't get sober. Guys like you die in public parks. And I said, but you drank like I drank. You got sober. And I'm fishing, you know. I'm trying to, because I've been to AA meetings before, you know. Give me an A. It's all going to be great. He's telling me the truth. And he said, well, with me, you know, a miracle happened in my life. And that's not easy to come by. Even if you come in, you go to these meetings and you do all the stuff we do, it's a slim chance for a guy like you. And I got scared. And at that moment, I was willing to, for the first time in my life, I was even willing to consider a power greater than myself. And I was willing to look to it. Because up to that point, God was just for, you know, people who didn't know how to dress or like to be on TV. Like, it had nothing to do with me. All of a sudden, God had a purpose. God had a function. And I was willing to seek that because I needed to get sober and I couldn't. And we were pretty much through the first step. We talked about how my thinking wasn't right and it wasn't going to get better. That I can't think my way through not drinking. I'm always going to, approached with the idea of a drink, it's always going to sound like a good idea to me. It's the way my brain works. I'm a chronic alcoholic. And like I said, I had become willing to throw all my eggs in one basket, you know, that whole power greater than myself gimmick. And in the third step, I agreed to go on to the rest of the steps, and I asked that power greater than myself to help me, and I cut a deal there. If I could be relieved of this, that I would do everything I could to carry the message to every drunk I could ever find. And then he wrote out a resentment for me, and he wrote out a fear, and he wrote out right out of the big book, you know, and he showed me how to do my sex list, and I went home and I did all that stuff, and I got together with him and I told him all that stuff, and we talked about all of it, and it was amazing and it was enlightening and it changed my view of the world completely. And you know, you guys don't have the pamphlet here, but my favorite pamphlet is A Member's Eye View. And in there, he mentions that the goal of every human being is to be able to stand naked, stripped of all pretense, all your bullshit, in front of another human being who's done the same thing and be loved and accepted. And that was what I experienced. After doing that fifth step with him, I understood that all my problems were me, man, that I had caused all this crap. That all of it was me. And I've never met anybody who wanted a tumor removed as badly at that moment as I wanted all this crap that I was removed. And I went home and I earnestly asked that power greater than myself to remove it. And then I started going out and making those amends. And you know, a lot of them, I think the last amends I could think of that had to be made, I made when I had 20 years, you know. And I was finally able to hit, that guy was willing to talk to me. And I was able to make amends to him a little over a year ago. And from that point, I said, what do I do now? And he said, go out there and screw everything up as bad as you can and figure out how to stay sober through it and grow. And I started going to meetings and talking to drunks and hanging out at the drunk tank and all that stuff. And it, at a certain point, I met this chick, you know, I met her, and she was, you know, she was that kind of chick that God made when Mrs. God wasn't looking. She had green eyes and red hair, and we started hanging out. And she said, by the time, this was when I had about a year and a half, and she said, I got to go home. She said, my grandfather's sick, you know, I got to go home. You want to go with me? And I thought she was talking about, like, wherever it was she went when she wasn't at my house. And I said, sure. And I found out that we were going to some place called Florida. And everybody I knew rant, you know, you can't go, you're going to die, you're going to drink, you're leaving your support system. And I was like, man, if God don't travel, God ain't worth nothing to me. I'm good to go. And we got in this crappy little car with four bald tires and no spare, and we took off in the middle of winter across America, hitting like two meetings a day, and zigzagged all over the place. And we almost made it here once, and then we realized that we had to go to the Elvis Presley Hotel and then go back. We met Bill Wilson, the tattoo artist. You know, I just had the urge to get some ink and dropped in on this dude, and it turned out he had 11 years of sobriety and just all this crap. And we ended up here, and you know, Alcoholics Anonymous for me has been carrying the message and carrying the message to anybody who will listen to me for 5 minutes. And doing all the stuff, you know, in AA. I'm a student of our book. I'm thrilled by our history. I'm interested in every little bit of it. I really like guys who like the same stuff I do, which I suppose is normal. I very rarely really like guys who don't like the things I like. You know, that daughter, it took a while. I was freaking out when I got sober that my sponsor, you know, I'm like, but what about? And he's like, man, when it's time, God will put her in your life, but you can't do nothing. And when she was old enough to pick up a phone, she got a hold of my number and she called me. And we have established a magnificent, she was about 11, you know, and now she's older than I was when I stopped drinking. And I got a couple of beautiful grandsons, and I got to give her away at her wedding, and we talked for about 45 minutes every day, whether I have time to or not. And usually it's about her hair and who's upset her today and how crazy her mother is. And I'm really good about it. I'm like, honey, she's your mom. Just be cool, you know. She's insane. I'm like, it's okay, you know. She drives an ice cream truck. It's okay. And I'm really good friends with my son-in-law, and I just love the hell out of my grandkids. And you know, that woman I came out here with, we're still together like 20 years later. You know, there's been a lot of room for growth, and we have a 14-year-old son, and I got to tell you, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has at least for me informed me on how to be a dad to him, you know, all the way through all this. You know, it's funny, about, I don't know, a year and a half ago now, it's weird. It's got to be weird being the kid of somebody who's me, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, because a drunk guy who was the same age I was when I got sober showed up, you know, puking and shaking and smelling like 100 miles of cheap whores and just a train wreck and wanting to kill himself in the living room and all this stuff. And my kid looked at him and said, you've been drinking, huh? And he said, he's crying. My kid went and got a trash can and set it next to him and got me a cup of tea and said, I'm going to go play video games. And he said, you'll be all right. And went and closed the door, you know, and the same thing that guy did for me. I love my kid. You know, he came home today. He's on honor roll again, you know, and that's all his mom. You know, that's all his mom. She actually went to school. He's in eighth grade now, so he's got more education than me. We both take meetings into, my wife and I, not my kid. We both take meetings into into jails and are members of big book groups in different counties because it works better that way, even though sometimes we sponsor decide to live with each other, which gets confusing, but that's not my fault. And you know, all right, it's time to shut this down. So I did really good. I wasn't preachy this time. I always get yelled at for being too preachy. So I'm going to be preachy. I got to get in a little since, you know, when after Bill died, Lois kept up with Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, she loved Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill's wife, and she was a huge part of us getting to be here right now, you know, so she kept up with what was going on. And when she was sick and she was dying, she was in the hospital and had tubes going down her throat. And one of the guys from General Service went to visit with her and just catch her up on the scuttlebutt because she liked to know what was going on in AA worldwide. And he said, he stopped and he said, you know, Lois, I want you to know that every one of us appreciate what you did for us. That if it weren't for you, Bill would have never been able to make it. You know, that it was your support and you being there that allowed this whole thing to happen. And and she grabbed her little pad of paper because she couldn't talk, and she wrote on it. She handed it to him. She said, "You know, not me, God." And he said, "I know, but you know, you were His messenger." And and she wrote on a little piece of paper and she handed it back to him, and it said, "And so are you." And you know, every one of you guys in here, you know, if you're that person. You know, you're here to carry that message to the new person who's out there dying. Somewhere really close to here right now, an alcoholic is being born. And it's going to be ugly and it's going to be horrible. And when they show up here, they are going to stink and they are going to cuss and they are going to be really unfriendly to you. And whether you like it or not, you got this gift. And it's yours to give away, whether you like them or not, whether it's fun or not. That's my only thing to do here. My sponsor took me through the steps and said, good luck. And all I got, all I really got in life is the ability to carry this message, something nobody else can do. Only an alcoholic can carry this message. So I admonish you now, study your book, learn who we really are. And if you ever hear me, please, you guys go on the hunt. If you hear me say something that you can't, that I cannot show you in that book, call bullshit on me. Because I feel really comfortable in doing that to everybody I'm around. I like it. It's not as much fun now. When I was new, it was great to fuck with a guy who had like 30 years. Now it's not really, there's no sport to it, and you can't pick on new people. So I just got to sit there and draw pictures on my hands. And I don't know. I'm really grateful you guys asked me to come do this, and I really love being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really hope that every one of you has the opportunity to pass this gift on to somebody else. Thanks.
Sorry, that's Lori, not Lloyd. Hi, I'm Lori Atchley, and I'm an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message. I get a big thrill out of... I can't read. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear these two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.